your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
That holiday is coming up. The one whose real goal, getting us to purchase cards and jewelry, is marketed as the day when you express your love, happiness, affection, warmth. But for some, this is just pressure to do just the right thing. Or even worse, sadness from feeling left out. I ask, what is love? We know love is a many splendid thing, and that love is blind. I have heard it is better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. I was told that if I love someone, to set them free. From Shakespeare to Socrates, the sting, love is important but mystifying. Like a rumor, everyone talks about it, but no one truly knows anything. You certainly hear it mentioned frequently for something apparently so rare. I love my children. Ooh, I love my new television. And even, don't you just love that new Ben & Jerry's flavor? I suppose for some, love is as common as a telemarketing call. I read some funny lines lately about love. If love is the answer, could you please rephrase the question? Never regret love. When it's good, it's wonderful. And when it's bad, it's expertise. Love is the triumph of imagination over intelligence. Each made me laugh with that underlying twitch that goes with someone's joke hitting a little too close to home. Oh man, that was funny. Oh wait, she wasn't talking about me, was she? And why are so many of the things I love embarrassing? People laugh when I admit that someone in their 40s loves a little Frank Sinatra mixed with his Blue October, and that sometimes a great Saturday is still just watching cartoons. Alright, well, old cartoons. But then, who doesn't love Rocky and Bullwinkle? But then I stumbled upon an old Creole proverb. Tell me who you love, and I will tell you who you are. Well, I love Sarah Landon. Use that to identify me. All right, a little early, but that's my Valentine's Day promo. Hope you heard that, Sarah. All right, 11:04 here on the wake-up call. next week, we will actually do a Valentine's show. Today, because of the way it falls on the calendar, we're going to talk politics. Last week was Super Tuesday with the primaries and caucuses. This coming Tuesday is the Virginia primary, and so I brought in my good friends here at the station, Pete Ronayne, an adjunct professor and dean of faculty at FEI, Federal Executive Institute, also does some work at the University of Virginia, and Dr. Jim Sofka, also an adjunct professor at the Federal Executive Institute. Gentlemen, how are you?
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Rick.
Thank you so much for being here on a blustery but otherwise nice Sunday.
And after your intro, I mean, I can feel the love in here.
Absolutely, especially with politics in the air.
You guys felt the love when you walked in the door, though.
That's true.
I had to share that with people who are listening today. All right. We are going to talk politics. We are going to talk about what happened last Tuesday. But I want to start sort of at the, you know, at the beginning, because I got to ask the really basic question yesterday. This coming Tuesday is the primary election here in Virginia. Right. I was asked, where do I vote and who can I vote for? This woman said, I am registered as a, you know, member of one party. Do I have to vote for someone from that party? So, guys, jump in and just lay out the groundwork.
No, Virginia's primary is open, which means that you can show up to the polls no matter who you voted for in the past, whatever party that you've supported, you can elect to vote for somebody in a completely different party. The only thing is, of course, you can't, it's not like Chicago in the old days, you can't vote early and often, you just get to pick one. So if you walk in there and you've supported a Republican in the past and you want to vote in the Democratic primary, that's it. You tell the election official which primary you want to vote in and you vote there. You would vote at your normal polling place, that's the place where you actually vote in this primary, same as you would for any other election. And the specific times and all of that are available at the local and state Department of Election website. All that information is available locally. So if you have any questions or you're not sure, just double check online or with the State Board of Elections. But the primary is open, which makes Virginia very interesting because people could vote for really whoever they want in whichever primary they want.
And the primary is this Tuesday. There was some confusion. I know some Virginia voters showed up last Tuesday thinking that this state was part of Super Tuesday, which, of course, it was not. So hopefully they maintain their zeal for whichever candidate and will show up this Tuesday.
All right. And polls open, what, 7 in the morning?
I think that's right, 7 o'clock.
And you vote where you voted at any other, you know, assuming that you haven't moved, you vote
your regular
you voted the last several elections.
Yeah, the kind of regional location they assign you to. Yep.
Okay. Right. By the way, 11:07 here in the wake-up call, Pete Ronayne, Jim Sofka here as we talk politics. And, let me squeeze this in because one of the reasons we can have these guys on and keep you well-informed and for some of you well-biased, we want to thank Blue Ridge Graphics for their support. Meade Avenue and East High Street here in Charlottesville. They provide custom T-shirts, possibly political ones, and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. You guys mentioned the fact that Virginia was not a Super Tuesday primary. People confused it with a Super Tuesday primary. And if you follow politics at all, so many of the primaries changed the dates that they had from the last few years. Everything went earlier and earlier and earlier. And I'm curious as to how that affected where we are now. So many people dropping out. Pretty much just two Democrats and 1.5 Republicans because Mitt Romney dropped out, but Mike Huckabee is still in it and had a good day yesterday.
Right, he did.
Although he's still quite far behind. I'm curious as to how moving things forward. Two states got punished, right? Michigan for Republicans.
And Florida.
Michigan and Democrats for the both of them for the Democrats, actually.
Okay.
Michigan and Florida. They will not seat the delegates, but that's now going to be contested, especially by the Clinton campaign.
All right. We'll explain that a little bit later. But how much did it affect where we are today, moving everything so far forward in the calendar year?
I would say, well, it definitely has affected it in terms of making money more important than ever. And it wasn't really, the idea was not to have it come out the way that it came out. The Democrats were the ones that really pushed the early calendar. Terry McAuliffe, who's the DNC chair, fundraising chair, has argued that really by getting in an early primary schedule, the logic would be that Hillary Clinton would have been the presumed nominee and then could devote all this time and energy to battling whoever the Republican would be. And, of course, no one on the Democratic side expected that you would see this kind of neck-and-neck horse race be with a real contender to Hillary Clinton's claim to be the presumptive nominee. So the idea was to try and move it up to sort of coronate someone, and what they've gotten is a real fight. And that's one of the reasons why money's become more important. Competing for a finite number of donor pools has made the Democratic Party sort of stretched financially. It's one of the reasons why Hillary Clinton had to loan her campaign money out of her own pocket, as it were. So it really has sort of moved this calendar up, but yet you're going to have a race probably all the way to the convention on the Democratic side, even by starting the process really in late 2007. It hasn't solved that problem of avoiding a fight that will probably go all the way to the convention.
Yeah, I would agree with Jim, particularly on the money issue, sort of an unanticipated consequence, since nobody emerged as a clear front runner. I mean, we had the myth of national polls well before before a single ballot was cast, in which Hillary Clinton had a commanding lead. But those are based more on name recognition than anything else. But people seem to get caught up in that, thinking that Hillary was clearly the presumptive nominee. This front-loading of the election timeline would benefit coronating somebody early and letting them get it on and focus on whoever their GOP adversary was going to be. But of course, the whole issue of momentum and politics is not necessarily predictable, allowed another contender to emerge, and it makes it a lot more expensive. It becomes truly a national-type campaign, smaller states with even a small number of delegates, which in the past you might basically just sort of blown off politically, mm-hmm. become that much more important when you are in a scrap of a fight for every single delegate. And so to be able to run a national campaign and move from South Carolina and then go to Nevada, spend some time in Florida, it becomes very costly, and it forces those second-tier contenders to drop out a lot earlier.
Yeah, that was one of the, I guess, one of my own mistaken thoughts, was that people kept calling this was still a fight after Super Tuesday. And I'm looking at the little calendar or the little, state geographical breakdown, and Clinton has won New York. She won Florida. She won California. And in the past, you'd say, okay, baby, you know, all you have to win is either Texas or Ohio or Pennsylvania, and you pretty much put this in your pocket. And then just last night, there are three states that you might otherwise have written off or as not being that big a deal. Was it Washington, Louisiana, and Kansas?
Nebraska.
And Obama wins all three, and now they're only, because they were so close. And Pete, like you said, what are they, 20 delegates apart, at least for all? I think it was like 1,035 to 1,020 or something
close.
Like that.
Yep.
So I think for a lot of people who certainly like myself, who follow the politics, but on a much shallower scale than the two of you do, I was very surprised.
Well,
having those big states, which in the past, when you watch the big board up on NBC or whatever channel you watch on election night, and they say, oh, that one's going to put them away, it's not happening this time.
Yeah, and you could argue that it in fact makes it a lot more small d Democratic, in that voters in Washington, Nebraska, Louisiana, and coming up on Tuesday, the Potomac primary with D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, that becomes much more important. So those voters, all of whom seem to be more interested as well, are also a lot more enfranchised, and it's not just a done deal. So if you're thinking about it just in terms of participation and a sense that your vote counts, et cetera, this is a good thing for American politics in a general sense.
Yeah, the Democrats adopted different rules than the Republicans. The Republicans, Rick, you know, when you look at the board and you see the states, that really explains it for the Republicans. You win the state, and that's it. Whereas for the Democrats, that's not the case. It's all proportional. Each candidate gets a percentage of the delegates depending upon how well they do. And as Pete said, that was designed to make it small d Democratic back in the 1970s when the Democrats first did this. It was also designed to force a convention. The Republicans wanted to sort of get people in, get a nominee, and the convention becomes a lot of marketing to introduce that candidate to the electorate. The Democrats and Democratic conventions, of course, most notably Chicago, 1968, can be real fights between candidates, and the Democrats have sort of liked doing that. And that's probably what's going to happen this year. And also, as you said, you look at Florida, you look at Michigan, these really large populous states. Well, they're irrelevant for the Democrats because the DNC has refused to seat those delegates. So Hillary Clinton's victory in Florida was a formality in terms of gaining any power.
Right, it was just a headline in the paper.
That's right, exactly. She milked it for all it was worth and got some criticism from Obama and Senator Edwards when he was still in the race at that time. But it doesn't have any real impact on political power other than the optics and the acoustics of how it plays in the blogosphere and everywhere else.
And because of that proportional distribution of the delegates, it makes it different than when we're looking at that electoral map in November for the presidential election. And you're right, Rick, you look and you see whoa, New York went to this one party, this candidate won California. In that case, they win all those electoral votes. So it is much, there's much more finality and importance to those states. Not to minimize at all California, New York, New Jersey, but it allows for much more balance, where Obama has simply won more states up to this point, and Hillary Clinton has won some of the larger states. So it's an interesting dynamic that obviously is still very much up in the air.
Yeah, it's just a different viewpoint than what most people are used to from election night.
And there are two clear schools of thought. I mean, we're talking about the Democratic side, but about a long, a more drawn out campaign. You know, somewhat arguing, as Jim mentioned, in the Democratic Party, let's have a coronation early. Let's not eviscerate ourselves. You know, we're punch weary by the time we get to the convention in Denver, and because we've been beating each other up, and we've spent time and treasure, and now we're weakened by the time we get to face the GOP nominee. Others will argue you become a much more battle tested candidate. You will emerge with the strongest candidate by having them go through a bit more of a demanding primary and caucus season, where you've had to refine your issues, where you really had to clarify who you are to emerge as the favorite, so that you roll into the general election much tougher, much more prepared for a very intense struggle.
Yeah, and that's what I, you know, that's one of the questions that I have. By the way, you can add your question or comment, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS is toll free. Obviously, this topic goes out to everyone in all the listening areas. Pete Ronayne, Jim Sofka, professors at the Federal Executive Institute with strong political backgrounds. How much does who has the winning edge here? And I turn that in terms of Republican Party, Democratic Party. The media seems to be so focused, or much more focused, on the battle between the Democrats. Does that help them because the media is drawn to them over what's going on in the Republican Party? And so by the time it's all worked out, whoever wins the Democratic nomination will have had that many more headlines and that many more articles written on them? Or does it wear them down and allow the Republicans to prepare themselves, sort of like to go back to you know, go back to home base and strengthen up and focus on raising money, and so that then once they know who they're battling, they can come out, you know, unscarred and ready to go?
Well, conventional political wisdom would say that this fight between Clinton and Obama helps McCain, because he's now the presumptive nominee. He can focus on the election in November. He can mend fences with conservative voters who have been at odds with him in the past. Sooner or later, I think he and Mike Huckabee will have a sit-down discussion about Huckabee's role in this process and let Clinton and Obama go at each other. But I'm not sure this year that's going to work. I think that, as you suggested, the focus on the Democrats have been to their advantage. It excites people. The excitement on factor in this race is on the Democratic side, not the Republican side. And it's drawing people into the process. Because if you look at the numbers, and Pete and I were talking about this earlier, one thing that's really impressive here are the numbers of voters coming out in these primaries, especially young voters. The Democrats are mostly pulling people out who hadn't voted before, hadn't voted in a while. And that attention, I think, and building a base, regardless of it's Clinton or Obama, and let's face it, at the end of the day, the differences between them on policy positions are not that great, so accepting one could be tantamount to accepting the other in a general election matchup against McCain. I think it's actually going against tradition and working more in the Democrats' favor.
Yeah, I heard somebody say that it's not necessarily between Clinton and Obama. It's not whose politics, it's who you can be friends with.
In it's this personality, case, absolutely.
It's, you know, you sort of ignore the fact that one is an African American and the other is a woman. Mm-hmm. If that has ever been an issue for you, you know, genderism or racism, it's more like, you know, you don't notice that the guy's black. He's just always been your friend. Mm-hmm. You don't notice that, you know, the woman hangs out at the poker party. She's just always been there because you grew up with her.
Yeah. Well, and I think that plays into one of my sort of first laws of electability is likability. You got to have likability. And as individual voters, we're going to decide, Rick, as you suggest, do I find Hillary Clinton, Senator Clinton, more likable personally? Do I find Senator Obama more likable personally? That's kind of the first thing that you might not even consciously run through in your head. And then you go into some of the issues. I would also agree with Jim. I would buck the conventional wisdom on this one for two reasons. I think, number one, the prime beneficiary of a longer race between the Democrats is Senator Obama because of name recognition. The longer that he has an opportunity to be prominent, to get headlines like this weekend of sweeping those three states, it raises his profile. I mean, he has had to crawl from way far behind in terms of people just knowing who he is, not even what he is or what he stands for, but who he is. So I think it helps him in that regard. It's a wash for Senator Clinton at that level. We know who she is. That's pretty much set in stone. I also think it is to the detriment of John McCain because he has to try to campaign now against two nominees, not really sure who that's going to be. The Democrats can ease up on each other if they want and focus on Senator McCain, which both of them did in recent speeches.
Right, they spoke last night in Richmond.
Senator Clinton was in Richmond, and they both spoke out criticizing McCain, even in gentle terms, but allows them to focus a bit more of their fire on that one person versus each other.
All right, 1121 here on the wake-up call. Feel free, dial us up. Make your comments. Ask your questions. Dr. Jim Sofka and our old man, Pete Ronayne, here in the studio today. Let me tell you, the weather out there, markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley, high wind warning in the valley, a wind advisory till 7 p.m. tonight, gust of 50 miles per hour. Partly sunny and very windy today. Highs 50 to 55. A little cooler in Lynchburg and the valley. Clear and colder tonight. Lows 10 to 15 and below zero wind chill in some areas. Lower 20s in Lynchburg. Mostly sunny tomorrow. Highs 30 to 35. Upper 30s in Richmond and Lynchburg. Right now, clouds in almost all the areas. 48 in the valley. 51 in Lynchburg, 55 in Richmond, and 55 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
By the way, I hope you could follow all that weather stuff. Michael's here if you have a question about your particular area. It was a lot of stuff. But I want to thank markets of Tiger Fuel for helping us put that together. We also want to thank Gary Grant, Ted Henneberry, and Laura Stamp for contributing to the Fall Fund Drive. It's people like them that allow the wake-up call to be here every Sunday for you, as well as Student Bookstore and Pizzabella. Stay tuned. Tell a friend about the show and other programming that you like here. And be sure to be around at the end of March for the Spring Fund Drive. All right, let's see. We got a call. Make sure I got all my buttons pushed. We got Scott from Charlottesville. Hey, Scott.
Hey, good morning. I think it'd be fun to have your guests pretend that they are the campaign manager for each of the respective three essentially remaining candidates and kind of boil it down to what would your strategy be over the next year to get your particular candidate elected? What message or, you know, even two brief messages would you want to hammer home for each of them?
All right, gentlemen.
You want to go first, Jim?
Sure, why not? Okay, I'll put my campaign manager hat on here, and I'll say that I would agree, picking up with Pete's last comment, I would agree. Obama's strategy is to stay alive, keep the stories in the media, keep him this sort of insurgent candidacy that he's been portraying to and drawing great crowds, keep that going as long as he possibly can. At this point, he's more of a phenomenon than an issue candidate. People are really into him and his story, and it's been working for him. So if I were Obama's manager, that's what I'd be focusing on. John McCain is probably has the easiest time. He's sort of consolidating the base of his party. He's going to focus relentlessly on national security, the war in Iraq. He's going to have to broaden his issue base a little bit more for some of the economic issues that he hasn't been paying as much attention to on the campaign trail. But McCain's sort of is running as the candidate of
a change in direction from the Bush administration, but building on an incumbent president's work for the past 8 years. The person I would not want to be, in terms of being a campaign manager, would be Hillary Clinton's, because that's very difficult, because she's had to completely rewrite her playbook. By now, this was assumed to be a glide path to the nomination. It was going to be a glowing biography of her and of Bill Clinton's role in the good times of the 1990s. And now she's, literally fighting for her political life. And so that campaign is going to have to focus really on the superdelegates. I think that's the campaign strategy that Hillary Clinton needs to work on. She needs to do as well as possible with the primaries. And if she walks into the convention with even a handful of delegates below Senator Obama's, there are 800 delegates in Denver who can vote for whomever they want to. And Bill and Hillary Clinton have spent a lot of time cultivating these people. And she has, by the counts you see in the political press, about a 2-to-1 advantage right now. So her focus is going to be the party base, the party machine, and delivering it at the convention. Obama's the insurgency, and McCain is really consolidation.
Yeah, I would jump in on the Obama side. His messaging clearly works, the message of change. Whether you buy into it or not as an individual, he can present that in the most authentic way possible. And after 8 years of any administration in office, whether it was 8 years of a Clinton administration or now 8 years of a Bush administration, the nation at large tends to be interested in change. But to get more specific, I think Obama's strategy, which has been part of what he's doing already, I would keep it in the game plan, is the youth vote, is reaching out to young voters. What we're already seeing is he wins in these primaries and caucuses with margins of 3-to-1 and 2-to-1, depending on where you are, on the 30 and under vote. And really, he wins in the 30 to 40, 42 demographic as well. And up to this point, that has been more than enough to blunt Senator Clinton's advantage in the 65-plus voters. I mean, there are some areas where youth vote and youth participation in these primaries and caucuses has been up 135% over last election cycle, which is dramatic, and we're expecting at least a 10% jump in voting in the presidential election. So I think what he's been doing, he's reached out to young voters. He has Hans Reimer from Rock the Vote from MTV as a key coordinator of his youth outreach. Some things he brings that just help him. I mean, he looks different. He speaks in kind of a post-racial way that appeals to younger voters. He meets with youth leaders after speeches, for example, not leaving that just to the big donors, et cetera. So I would focus on that and focus on that notion of change. We can talk about there's a huge generational angle to this entire campaign, which is fascinating. If I'm Senator McCain, the heavy lifting he has to do, and this is, everybody knows this, is to shore up the core conservatives, the more Christian fundamentalist conservative base who will turn out, who are powerful players in this election, and he struggles with that cadre of voters. You could see that in the results this weekend, where Mike Huckabee, I mean, he's not going to be a powerful player, but Huckabee's showing this weekend indicated McCain's problem on that side. He's got to shore up that sort of far right, if you will. The best way he can do that is actually, there's nothing that he can do. He can hope for Hillary Clinton to be the nominee. That's his best choice of shoring up those voters. I agree with Jim on Senator Clinton's side. She sort of has the hardest task, because her script is a bit more set in stone. As I mentioned before, we know who she is. We know her experience. We know her competence. We pretty much know where she stands on the issues. I think that there's one specific electoral strategy. It's even further outreach into the Hispanic community, where she does extremely well. That is obviously a growing demographic in this nation. It powered her to victory in California. And if she continues that can be her edge.
All right, Scott, thanks for calling, man. Good question to get these guys all riled up. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS for your question or comment on the day. Jim, you mentioned the 800 delegate votes out there once they get to Denver. Explain what a superdelegate is, why it's there, and you mentioned a little bit about how it would and could affect the nomination. But it's confusing to me.
Yeah, well, it's confusing to a lot of people. The Democrats sort of have these very cumbersome rules, whereas Pete said they want to be small-D Democratic, and they want to encourage all the voices in the party, which is why they have this proportional representation. You get a percentage of the vote depending upon how well you do in the election. But then, in order to give the party machinery some muscle, they created this idea of a superdelegate. They are not elected. They are appointed through the party. They are big-name political figures, governors, senators, congressmen, people very closely involved with the party. And they essentially are not representative of a particular state electorate, the way that you would, for example, in a direct primary or caucus. They sort of are the conscience of the party. And they can vote for whoever they want. And there's usually their role is ceremonial. There really hasn't been a case where you've had it, you know, become down to, you know, hen's teeth in picking these superdelegates. And this year there might be.
What's the percentage? There are 800 superdelegates. How many other delegates are there?
The superdelegates are about a fifth of the total.
All right.
About a fifth. Yeah, so you're dealing now with another, on top of anything that you walk into Denver with, you've got another 20% or so of an electorate, of these delegates. Now, the idea here was to sort of focus on unifying the party, and these folks would be able to vote largely on the idea of who's the most likely, or to use Pete's phrase, electable candidate to fight the Republicans. And this year, like I said, going into it right now, Senator Clinton would have about a 2-to-1 advantage out of that pool of just under 800 superdelegates.
But you're talking about as of today.
As of today, which is a great advantage.
I mean, who they would vote for, it's like we went back to the who's your friend.
That's right.
It can change. Two-thirds would vote for her because of the old contact that they've had with the Clinton family.
Absolutely.
For so long. Not necessarily because, as of today, they think Clinton has a better chance of beating McCain.
But to jump in, sort of further confuses it, but it's an important point. It's not a 2-to-1 advantage of the total. It's a 2-to-1 advantage of those who think they've decided who they're going to back. So of those almost 800, 204 have at this point decided, this is according to the New York Times, decided to back Senator Clinton, with just about 100 backing Senator Obama.
Wow, but so that's still at least 500 who haven't decided anything.
Out there. And as Jim mentioned, you know, if they get caught up in the momentum or the point of the superdelegates, as Jim mentioned, was to say, we want popular participation, we want popular activism, but we also want, kind of like the Electoral College itself, we want people with a broader view, long-standing party activists, so the governors from all the states, the senators and representatives, et cetera, people who have connections to the party and might have the art of the long view. Maybe, because of course they have their own subjectivities. And if you're a superdelegate from a state that, let's say, went for Obama, but as you're approaching convention time, you see a lot more momentum moving towards Senator Clinton, you think, you know what, I know this is what my state said, but my role as a superdelegate with this higher sort of perspective says, I want to unify this party, I want to get this done, I'm going to throw my support to Senator Clinton, or vice versa. It was an attempt to get it away from just political zealots, if you will, and allow long-standing party activists to have a bit more say in what happens. And again, it all depends on how the primaries and caucuses shape out. Recently, it really hasn't mattered that much. You probably have to go back to Mondale and Hart, who approached the convention in 82, pretty much deadlocked after all the primary season. And Mondale managed to win the superdelegates, and that's what put him over the top.
Got a call coming in, so let me thank Vivace for supporting us today. It is Charlottesville's Taste of Little Italy and Seville Weekly's Reader's Choice in the Italian Restaurant category from the annual Best of issue. Vivace features service, a full bar, and a wide-ranging menu with lounge 7 days a week. And on Valentine's Day, your special someone deserves Vivace. Reservations are suggested. You can find them on Ivy Road next to Sneak Reviews. All right, we've been talking about politics, Super Tuesday this past week, upcoming election through. Democrats are in Denver when?
They are in Denver end of August. It would be August 25th to 28th.
Republicans are?
Minneapolis, September 1 through 4, so the following week.
You know, a quick before this call, or Michael brings through whatever we have. Obama, Jim, I think you said, has come out of nowhere. Had to fight his way up to where he is now. Who do you think the Clintons are mad at for giving him that keynote address? Was it 4 years ago, 8 years ago? Well, because isn't that what happened? Isn't that what put him on the landscape, was the keynote speaker address at the Democratic Convention from 4 years ago?
That's right. That was the Kerry campaign that decided to put him on there as sort of a different face, a face of the younger generation of the party. It was a brilliant keynote address. It was just a sort of fantastic speech. It was sort of like Mario Cuomo's in the 84 Democratic Convention. But also the fact that Obama, what he really focused on and what got him on the radar screen, was one of the few Democrats of sort of any national, even rising national stature, to be so outspoken on the Iraq war as early as late 2002. That's really what he built his, now things have changed, we're focusing on the economy now, but he built his reputation really on his, you know, outspoken opposition to the Iraq war, and that built him a sort of grassroots movement in the Democratic Party over the past couple of years. And with that, he's been able to, and his natural gifts as a speaker and a communicator, to propel himself as a national candidate, even though, as many people have noted, he really doesn't have a lot of national experience whatsoever, only having been in the Senate for a few years and then in the Illinois legislature before that. But I think it was the war more than anything that sort of built his political candidacy.
Right. And on the you mentioned that it was Obama who spoke at the convention that nominated Senator Kerry last time around. As I understand it, Senator Kerry is pledging support to Obama and is helping with his work to secure superdelegates for Obama.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because Kerry still is a big, you know.
Well,
and I say this I don't say this from personal viewpoint, but he is a big joke. He is still someone that the comedians make fun of. And so is it a good thing or a bad thing to have John Kerry publicly supporting you?
Well, I would say this. I understand where you're coming from, but the role that Kerry's playing, most importantly, isn't in public support, overt public support, but it's this very important behind-the-scenes working of lining up superdelegates. And he's very experienced at that, very well-connected party insider. So I would argue
he's using his background, not his stage.
Not his public
not his
persona.
Stage personality.
Not his public persona.
And he's much more effective, as Pete established, much more effective and much more respected, actually, even across the aisle in the Senate, is sort of more backroom political building than he is in public. So his role is not to be discounted, because it is going to come down to this role of these superdelegates who can be influenced behind the scenes. They're not accountable to a direct voter. And so the support of people like Senator Kerry, Senator Kennedy, who also came out for Barack Obama, is not to be discounted when it gets into the backroom dealings in that convention in Denver.
And just a correction, I misspoke before. The superdelegates were created in 1982, but it was the 1984 convention between Mondale and Hart where it came into play.
979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Pete Ronayne, Dr. Jim Sofka from the Federal Executive Institute, books, professorships, et cetera, all floating around the room here. Feel free to take advantage of it with your call or question. I got a call here about the vice president's stuff, but I want to wait till after the break to get into that.
Okay.
Somebody mentioned the word grassroots. Pete, I think you did. One of the things that I found interesting, and I think I heard this on NPR, I might have read it online somewhere, that pretty much 7 of every $8 donated to Obama comes from internet campaign, and that is played up as being a grassroots issue. Talk a few minutes, and again, we're getting close to time for the next break, but I want to hear more about that and the positive and negative aspect of that.
Whether that's exactly true or not, it does speak to a deeper phenomenon, and it's open to interpretation. It's clear that for Senator Obama, more of his money comes from smaller donors, so the well under $1,000 donors. And in part, that's a function of him being the new candidate, being less experienced and being in the Senate for a lot less time than a traditional nominee. So he's not as hardwired into the party machine. The Clintons, of course, have been the face, very public face, and really dominating Democratic politics for quite some time now. So they're extremely, have an extremely sort of well-oiled financial machine, which allows them to win over those larger donors. One's not necessarily better than others. The Obama campaign would certainly argue that it shows a broader, deeper support from some more sort of everyday Americans than the Clinton campaign.
And but, how's everybody doing for money now? I mean, you said Clinton had to donate money to herself. McCain can focus on raising money. Obama obviously needs money, regardless of whether he has tons or none. But how's everybody stand in terms of keeping up with one another?
Well, Obama's doing extremely well. He just opened 10 offices, campaign field offices in Texas, which isn't going to have a primary until March 4th. That's the next big round of states, along with, I think it's Rhode Island, Vermont, and Ohio. So he's doing very well. The Clinton campaign, I don't think, was expecting anywhere near this long of a haul. I mean, Obama, to go back to Scott's question, which is great before about campaign, in terms of being a campaign manager, since the Clintons assumed this was going to have been a done deal no later than Super Tuesday, there really wasn't an idea, a focus on the grassroots small donation contributions. Obama knew that he needed them and focused a lot on that and built on the work of Howard Dean, who showed the power of internet fundraising back in 2004 and did a very good job with it. So right now I would say that the money advantage is definitely on Obama's side, and as long as he can continue to rack up states, even with small delegate states, the idea being that he's going to show himself to be electable and start going after the larger donors. That's what Obama's going to do.
All right, let me take a quick break. Scott is back on the line. Scott, hang through until I do all the FCC and WNRN required items here at 1141.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, the Midnight Barbecue is a local show, radio and internet and YouTube. Not much like anything else out there. Music, politics, even a visit by a dominatrix. The Hook gets down and dirty with these guys. Read about Eric Prum's double life as a full-time UVA student and a guy who plays paintball professionally from coast to coast. And is it true Charlottesville might have a daily Amtrak train to New York City? Read all about it in The Hook, making sure your mind is ready for anything. Let's thank 45fix.com for letting us be here today. If you have a home improvement project, there's another way to find a contractor. It's 45fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate, no obligation estimates are available anytime. That's 45fix.com, the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And he reminds me, because he just wandered in the door, Drew Thompson is here at noon for Les Temps Purdue. Best of 80s and 90s alternative. For some reason, he plays no Tiffany or Metallica or New Kids on the Block, but you will hear Tears for Fears, Nirvana, and Lush. And he likes requests. Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music, here at noon. All right, let me fire it up so we can get Scott back on the phone. Hey, Scott.
Hey. Okay, so Clinton and Obama are currently the fun one and should remain interesting for a long time. But going back to McCain to maybe expand on one of the guests' earlier answers, if you watched Meet the Press last week, the two talking head couples, Marley Matlin and James Carville, really had a fairly vigorous debate on what it means for McCain to move, if he moves back to the conservative right religious vote, he loses a lot of the independence that and sort of his whole persona of being independent and more moderate that has sort of gotten him the nomination. So he is one way. He risks moving the other vote. Any comments on what his election strategy should be?
Well, let me toss in my viewpoint here before we get to the experts, which
yes,
is
and before you go with that, just I should say that Jim and I model ourselves after Matlin and Carville. So
I don't buy the fact that conservatives aren't going to vote for McCain just because if he keeps his stuff up and he needs to come back to their side and give up his independence. Because who are they going to vote for? Clinton or Obama? Or they're going to go Green Party or something? It's not going to happen. and he can be the person that he should be. He lost all of his respectability when he went down to Lynchburg and started shaking hands with Jerry Falwell, and that's when he fell out of the picture.
Right.
And now he's back up, and he needs to be the person that he is. If he wants to have any opportunity to win, they will come to him.
Yeah. Well,
that's my viewpoint. You guys fire off.
Let me build both on what you said, Rick, and take Scott's question in just a slightly different direction, because I agree. When push comes to shove, however conservative you are, if you're on the GOP side, you're either not going to vote or you're going to vote for McCain. But to Scott's point, here's where the peril lies for McCain. He has cultivated both genuinely and of course as part of his political persona the maverick idea, the straight talk express, and he does in actual numbers he does well with independent voters. That's where the risk is going to run in the general election for him if he feels a need to mollify the far right too much. He will alienate those centrist voters who are independent. Because, look, when it comes down to general election, that's where it's won or lost. Obama or Clinton are going to get there. One-third of Democrats are going to vote for them no matter what. The other candidate is not an option for them. McCain's going to get his one-third of the GOP voters who are going to vote for him no matter what. It's that middle third or so. That's probably not the exact numbers, but that's where the election rests. And if you're McCain and if you make the mistake or feel the need to or get pressured to lurch too far right, you will alienate those independent voters. It's another reason why McCain's electability strategy, interpreting it, he would love to have Senator Clinton be his opponent because Obama competes much more effectively for independent voters than does Senator Clinton.
Thanks, Scott. I'm going to let Jim talk and hang up the phone. I think that was a great question, and obviously it allowed me to release a little pressure.
It was a great question, and I agree with Pete that the conservative, I think that's overdone. That what the conservatives would hope, is a replay of 1994, where, okay, let's say it's Senator Clinton or Senator Obama becomes president, and let's say they do something, health care or another issue that the right opposes, they could use that in opposition to become the vanguard of a new conservative movement like Newt Gingrich and gain control of the House. That to me is fantasy. I mean, it might happen, but you don't bank on that. If you don't vote for McCain and you're a conservative GOP voter, you're going to guarantee a Democratic administration at a time when you've got a Democratic House and Senate, and the majorities in the House and Senate, if anything, are only going to get stronger. So
that's why I don't buy it.
I don't either. I agree that
all they want is to have him make a conservative selection for the vice presidential,
which he can do very easily. What he could do by let's say he were to pick Mike Huckabee as vice president, and to put a few and to promise Huckabee and some of the party insiders certain conservative appointments in his administration, he would then be establishing Huckabee's credentials to be the sort of presumed front runner in 12 or 16, whenever, depending if it's 4 or 8 years of a McCain presidency, and make them happy. They're never going to be completely happy with everything that McCain's doing. But people, the Republican right loves to venerate Reagan, but the Republican right was not always happy with everything that Reagan did or Richard Nixon before him. So I think to focus just on that right, or for the Democrats to focus just on sort of the MoveOn.org left, as Pete said, you're losing that vital center. And what makes this election interesting is Pete's correct. McCain has shown more than most Republicans an ability to attract independents and Democrats. Obama has demonstrated an ability to bring in a lot of independents and Republicans. And early polls, at this point they're almost meaningless, but they're showing that an Obama-McCain in a matchup, hypothetical, McCain-Obama-McCain-Clinton, Obama beats McCain anywhere from 5 to 8 percentage points. I mean, take that for what you will. But it would be a very interesting race with Obama and McCain, two candidates who can actually cherry-pick voters from the other's party. That would be a very interesting campaign to manage.
And one other thing worth mentioning, we get caught up in the purists versus pragmatists on both sides, but whether you're a conservative Republican or you're a liberal Democrat who's sort of enamored of McCain, Senator McCain is conservative. Make no mistake about it. You can go check his voting record. He has a fun personality. He's great on The Tonight Show, et cetera. Whatever your position leanings are, he is a conservative. There's no doubt about it.
All right, 11:48 here on the Wake Up Call with Pete Ronayne and Jim Sofka. As we talk about politics, I do still have this question about the vice presidential, and I want you guys to think about it because I got somebody on the line.
Okay.
But the call-in question, and I don't want anybody else to steal it from this caller, are the odds of a Clinton-Obama, Obama-Clinton ticket. and I know that's been discussed.
Sure.
But we're going to take Bob from Keswick. Hey, Bob.
How you doing, folks?
Hey.
My question is, are there any offices in Charlottesville for the candidates where someone can pick up lawn signs?
There's one for Obama, I know.
There's one for Obama on the downtown mall right next to the old Jefferson Theater. And I don't know that there's a Clinton office. I don't think so, but Jim, do you...
I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm sure that probably down there you're going to find people on the downtown mall, especially today, who are going to be setting literature up for everybody because they want to try and maximize coverage with signs. So I think if you went downtown, either for the Obama sign or anywhere, you probably would certainly be able to find stuff, I'm sure. I don't know anything off the top of my head.
And I think if you go online and ask for the smaller sign and donate $10 for them to send it to you, that you can have a yard sign to put up.
Yeah.
Oh, I know that I can go online and order it from the Hillary store if I wanted to have Hillary signs, but it just seems to be quite surprising that they haven't bothered to open an office.
Well, Obama's got his, and I think you guys are right. I haven't seen anybody else.
And that could be a reflection. I mean, I'm just speculating of the money issue as well. I mean, this expanded campaign, more of these states taking on prominence, and it's hard to have an office set up every single place. That's pure speculation. But anyhow.
All right,
okay,
Bob, thanks, man.
Thank you very much for your help.
Sure.
All right, let's thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for being with us today. Blue Ridge has gear for keeping you warm outside on the way to work or class or before being blown over on the trail. Blue Ridge staff can recommend the hat, pair of gloves, or jacket, including the Windstopper fleece from the North Face. It'll let you enjoy the outdoors anytime. You'll find Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barracks Road Shopping Center here in Charlottesville. They're at the Mountain Inn in Wintergreen or at brms.com. All right, phones open for the last 8, 9, 10 minutes here on the program before Les Temps starts up. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN Rocks. All right, guys, back to that question from the caller about the possibility of Clinton and Obama matching themselves together as a ticket.
Never going to happen.
I would say zero.
Absolutely not. It's just not. She would never ask him, and Obama might ask, but she would never take it. I think here this is a question of political egos. I think the idea, certainly, if Obama is the nominee, that Senator Clinton would not accept the vice presidency. I think it would be more to her advantage to stay in the Senate, and focus on a power base there. And I think that Senator Obama would probably, and certainly Senator Obama, would probably want to go with somebody completely different. This would be keeping with his campaign strategy not to go with Clinton. I think he would go with somebody who, say...
Bill Richardson?
I'm thinking with Obama, somebody, let's say, Sam Nunn. I'm thinking Richard Lugar. I'm thinking Lee Hamilton. Somebody with very strong foreign policy, national security credentials.
Someone to back up his "I haven't been around very long" kind of thing.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And Hillary Clinton, I think, would never give it to Obama. I think that she's, you know, really someone. She is someone, in my estimate, who holds a political grudge, and I do not think that I couldn't imagine that she would ask him. Pete, I don't know if you would agree with that.
I mean, I would agree. I think for each have real reasons not to either want it or ask the other. If you're Senator Obama, the sky's the limit for you. You could return to the Senate. You could maybe be governor of Illinois at some point. What's forgotten in that is a very powerful player in the Clinton administration is going to be the former president. So a vice president's going to be further overshadowed by those two political luminaries. It's a lose-lose for Obama. And I don't think he would pick Hillary, not just for personal reasons, but as Jim mentioned, if you're the candidate of change, and that has been the hallmark of your in defining message, you can't then select Hillary Clinton. I would agree that on the VP side, I think it'd be fascinating to see him try to be the unity candidate and reach out to somebody like Richard Lugar, the Republican senator who has foreign policy credentials. Same with Chuck Hagel from Nebraska.
Yeah, that's
would
good,
be a fascinating
pick.
Choice.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Also, anti-war. Sam Nunn is a good choice. You know, in Virginia, both Tim Kaine and Mark Warner's names get bandied about as potential VP. Tim,
right, before, I got to,
for either side.
I got Gary on the line. Gary, hang on for another 30 seconds. A couple names out there for McCain as vice. Who might be McCain's picks for vice presidency?
Well, he could go. I mean, he could go with somebody like Romney, but I think Huckabee is the more likely one for him. Huckabee's gone, has demonstrated an ability to appeal to a large block of the GOP and with almost no money. I mean, what's forgotten about this is Huckabee is running on a shoestring, and he's doing very well, particularly in the South. And he's a likable guy. He's a good candidate, a good speaker. So I would think that for McCain, Huckabee's the logical choice. It allows him to put Huckabee in the administration, to anoint him as his successor, to mollify the conservatives, and to get somebody who's a really good campaigner to go out there and sell McCain. That's what he wants. It's also to point out that Huckabee's almost 20 years younger than McCain.
Yeah.
So you've got a generational shift right there within the Republican Party. So to me, I mean, there's other people that he could put into the mix as well, but I think that would be his logical choice. I think the more interesting one would be with Hillary Clinton. Who would she go with? I still think John Edwards would be a good pick for her. He's more of an economic candidate, and I think that's what she's focused on quite a bit. So I think that in terms of, again, the Hillary Clinton campaign is the one with the most constraints right now, I think, in terms of possible choice. I would say McCain, Huckabee, Obama with a national security Democrat or liberal Republican, a Lugar, a Tom Kaine even. Hillary Clinton's going to go with somebody who's tried and true, who's not going to give her any surprises, and is going to, you know, want to play a role as VP, not only to her, but also, as Pete suggested, with Bill Clinton hanging in the background of everything in that administration. That's a tough bill to, you know, to fit.
All right, let me take this call. We got Gary from Albemarle. Hey, Gary.
Hey, Rick. Good morning. Great show. Very interesting. As a conservative voter, my conservatism is along the lines of fiscal conservatism. I'm not interested in social conservatism, moral, ethical, religious conservatism. Would your guests define for me what they mean by conservatism and which of these four candidates is the most fiscally conservative? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Ooh, excellent question.
That's a good point, because depending on who you are, you do define conservatism very, very differently. That fiscal conservatism you're looking for has been sorely lacking on both sides. Really, if you want to find the most fiscally conservative president we've had lately, believe it or not, you go back to Bill Clinton. He did the most to actually slow the growth of government, to reduce the deficit and the debt, et cetera. Of the candidates that you have to choose from right now, I would say that McCain probably in theory is the most fiscally conservative. But again, the GOP has had a hard time in marrying practice to philosophy on fiscal conservatism. They talk that game, but ultimately government grows, et cetera. But he's probably your best bet.
Well, that or Ron Paul. Ron Paul has built a campaign on fiscal conservatism. He wants to go back to the gold standard. He's favoring a very tight money. He wants to abolish not only the IRS, but the Federal Reserve, and focus and sort of take the economic powers away from the presidency, arguing that they're not there in the Constitution. So Paul is actually from the conservative fiscal libertarian side of the party, as opposed to, yeah, when we're talking conservative, we think more evangelical Christian conservative voters. I would say that not only McCain, but Ron Paul would actually, if you look online or you look at some of his literature, that's about as conservative financially as you're going to get to want to put the United States back on a gold standard, to have the currency backed up by specie.
Huckabee also does want to abolish the IRS, so that might appeal to you.
All right, thanks. You are listening to WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar, Amherst, Lynchburg, 1157 on the Wake Up Call, as we finish up our last few minutes here with Jim Sofka and Pete Ronayne. Remember, you can find this program www.sevillepodcast.com. There are places for you to make comments about this program in particular, or Wake Up Call in general, if there's other shows you'd like to see. Next week we'll be doing a Valentine's show where we're going to have a variety of folks in here, married, single, different genders, different ages, to talk about love and relationships. Last question or two here for you guys in front of me. Virginia primary on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen? Who's going to win? You mentioned that about the incredible increase in the outcome, number of people actually participating in primaries and caucuses across the country to this point. Expectations for Virginia.
Oh, I would say obviously on the, I mean, the Richmond Times-Dispatch actually has a poll in today's paper that shows obviously McCain winning, you know, handily the Republican side. And Huckabee, of course, will siphon off those more socially conservative voters. But the interesting statistic is that Obama's ahead, and this is pretty consistent in most polls, by at least 10%. The Richmond Times-Dispatch has him up by 53% to 37. Other polls, that's a little bit narrower. But it seems to be that in this Potomac primary in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, I think it's going to look like yesterday. My prediction would be an Obama sweep of all three.
And now, Pete, before you answer, Tim, our governor supported Obama or has given his support to Obama. Has the Maryland governor done the same? And what happens if Virginia actually takes Hillary Clinton?
I don't know that the Maryland governor has...
Yeah, he did. O'Malley supported Hillary Clinton.
Hillary, okay. Yeah, which sort of makes sense. O'Malley's a bit more of an older hand.
So somebody, well, I guess both of them could be, but if there's going to be a sweep, somebody is not going to have lived up to giving the state to the person he supported.
That's true. That is true. And I would agree with Jim, there's going to be a sweep. What's interesting in Virginia as well is that men prefer Obama to Clinton so far in polling, 59 to 32, which is a huge lead, not necessarily surprising. What's more surprising is currently, and this might change when people actually vote, he's leading with women. Senator Obama is 49 to 41. And for the broader Potomac primary, right now, surveys from the Boston Globe published this weekend had Obama leading Senator Clinton 52 to 33 in Maryland, and McCain leading Huckabee 56 to 17. I would agree with Jim that it will be a Senator Obama sweep. That's going to be significant momentum coming off of this sort of like an extended weekend.
But you should still go out and vote.
Absolutely.
Because whoever you're supporting, this is an important time of year. Don't give up on Clinton if that's who you think
that's right.
You is either, going to lose. You should vote for her anyway.
You
or
vote
which, whoever you.
You vote because you want to blunt the sweep, or
and as we
miracle,
and as we learned in New Hampshire, polls aren't always right.
That's absolutely right.
That's exactly
all right, guys, thanks so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Rick. Of course, we'll have you back on before the presidential election once we get everything all settled. All right, Drew Thompson up next with Les Temps-Perdue. Be here next week for the Valentine's Fiesta.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.org. The wake-up call is produced by Michael Strickland. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.